Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. The House Ag Committee Thursday held a hearing to review the state of the livestock industry. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack was among those to testify.
It's an extraordinary set of complex factors to be examined when we talk about the livestock industry in the United States. Supply, demand, capacity, competition, markets, and many, many factors making it an incredibly difficult industry, whether it's weather, feed costs, vertical integration, supply chain disruptions, packing and slaughter capacity, ownership, consolidation, competition, trade, import, port congestion, seasonality, many, many other factors make it extraordinarily complex. Our inventories are down in beef and pork and poultry for a variety of reasons, whether it's drought or disease or disruption of the supply chain. At the same time, we are seeing incredibly high demand domestically and exports at a high level, in fact, setting a record for the level of ag exports this year. We know that there is a high concentration in this industry. We know that it creates capacity challenges, especially in beef, and there is a need for additional capacity. That's one of the reasons why we began the process of establishing a $500 million fund. We have solicited information and input from those who are interested in potentially utilizing this fund. We've received over 500 comments, and we're now in the process of analyzing those comments in order to establish and structure the program. The expectation is that that structure will take place sometime before the end of the year, and that we'll begin to make decisions and investments, hopefully in the first quarter of 2022. We need additional capacity. We also need to strengthen our existing local and regional small and very small processing facilities, and that's the reason why we've used the resources provided by Congress to, as Representative Thompson indicated, to assist in reducing overtime costs. Over 1,879 facilities have already received assistance and help from the USDA as a result of that program that you all put in place. We also have taken a look at the opportunity to modernize existing facilities with the resources established by Congress. We have over 245 applications that are in the process of being reviewed now for the roughly $55 million available for that purpose. We also recognize that in addition to additional processing capacity and supporting our existing facilities, we need to make sure that we address the issue of training and workforce. That obviously involves, as well, immigration reform. Certainly pleased that the House of Representatives was able to pass the Farm Worker Modernization Act and hope that the Senate is able to do so as well. The goal here is obviously to strike a better balance between supply and demand, between processing capacity and competition, with greater transparency so that we can have a stable, dependent, and fair market. At the end of the day, our department is anxious to have fair prices for producers and a fair deal for consumers. Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd be happy to respond to questions from the committee.
Thank you, Secretary Vilsack, for your excellent testimony today. At this time, members, we are going to open it up for questions for the Secretary. Members will be recognized for questions in order of your seniority, alternating between majority and minority members. You will be recognized for 5 minutes each in order to allow us to get as many questions in as possible. Again, I remind each of you to please keep your microphones muted until you are recognized, so that we can minimize background noise. Now, I recognize my own self here, Secretary, and again, welcome. And I want to start off by saying thank you. And you and I have been working together on some very, very serious issues facing us. And I'm delighted to be a partner with you as we deal with so many of the issues facing agriculture now. I've been especially encouraged by the recent announcement that you made out of the U.S. Department of Agriculture that's related to your bold and great efforts to combat African swine fever. And we refer to it now as ASF. And you, as you also know, this is a priority to many members on our House Agriculture Committee. And I was so pleased to hear that you had some news and you were kind enough to call me and share the news before you made it, that the USDA has a promising vaccine candidate for the African swine flu. I have also been a firm believer that, as I mentioned to you, that investment in federal research is very critical to advancing the agriculture industry. And this important work that is going on with our Agricultural Research Service is evidence of that. And so my first question to you, Mr. Secretary, is what are the next steps that you have that involves advancing this vaccine? And also, how long until we can expect it to be ready for use?
Mr. Chairman, there are actually seven vaccines that are currently under investigation and examination at various ARS facilities in USDA. The specific vaccine that you're referring to has recently gone through sort of the first steps or stages of testing and appears to be very effective against the Asian version of African swine fever. There is still quite a bit of work yet to be done before that particular vaccine is capable and able to be utilized in the market. There are additional steps and responsibilities that are undertaken. It's going to take some time, additional field tests. I also understand that there is also an effort potentially to involve Vietnam that's currently dealing with African swine fever in terms of doing some testing, additional testing. So while I am anxious, as you are, to get this to the market as quickly as possible, we have to do so in a way that ensures the safety of it. But it's moving forward, as are the other six possible candidates.
Secretary, it's come to my attention that evidence that economies of scale have driven consolidation in meatpacking and that larger facilities operate more efficiently. How do we strike a balance between benefits and costs of concentration?
Mr. Chairman, I think the key here is to have a resilient and efficient system, which means that I think we need to continue to support our small and very small processing capacity, as I mentioned in my statement, but we also need to expand capacity. There's no question that we are short of capacity, which is one of the reasons why it's more difficult for farmers to get a fair price for what they're raising. Now, that's the reason why we've put together this fund. As I indicated, we've got 500 comments in terms of how it should be structured, in terms of grants, loans, guaranteed loans, forgivable loans. We're in the process of finalizing the structure. Hopefully by the end of this year, we have the structure in place so that we can begin accepting applications.
And Mr. Secretary, you mentioned barriers. Identify these barriers. What are the barriers to enhancing our meat processing capacity and supply chain resilience?
I'd say two principal barriers, Mr. Chairman. Capital is one of them. And then secondly, I think there is still the need for us to invest in additional training and additional workforce.
Very good. And now I will turn to the gentleman from Pennsylvania, our ranking member, Mr. Thompson. You're now recognized for your 5 minutes.
Well, Chairman, once again, thank you for this hearing. Much appreciated. Mr. Secretary, I share your commitment to enhancing the resilience of our, that part of that can be achieved through increasing processing capacity across the country. Unfortunately, this topic, some of the department's actions simply didn't match its rhetoric. The lack of an appeal in the new swine inspection system case is a notable example. And while I certainly would be curious to hear the explanation for why this administration chose not to appeal ruling with the potential to reduce national swine packing capacity by 2.5%, I have my suspicions. I don't think it's probably today, it's more constructed to focus on what is being done, obviously, to address this problem. I have heard that progress is being made on a solution, but things have been held up by the White House. Mr. Secretary, can you clarify what is being done to remedy this situation for both the affected processing facilities and the producers? And when can we expect to see these solutions finalized and even more importantly, implemented?
Mr. Thompson, Representative Thompson, I'm sorry, you cut out a little bit during the course of your question. I want to make sure I understand it. Are you asking about the effort to expand processing, or are you asking about line speed, or both? I think we can all agree we need to expand broadband.
Yeah, better technology.
Mr. Chairman, let me see if I can respond to the ranking
sure.
member's question.
Go right ahead.
Both on both line speed and processing. On the processing side, as I indicated, the resources for the assistance to modernize existing facilities so they could potentially qualify for federal inspection and interstate transactions. We received 246 applications for those resources, and we're in the process of reviewing those applications and making the grants of up to $200,000 with a match requirement. On the $500 million, as I indicated, we had 500 comments. We're in the process of finalizing the structure of how that program is going to be adopted, and I expect and anticipate we'll begin making investments at the beginning of next year in the first quarter. On the line speed issue, the Department of Justice makes these decisions. Candidly, the previous administration did not put into the record any information relating to worker safety. The court found that to be a fatal error in that line speed determination. The reality is we're now working with both the industry and those who represent workers to try to figure out ways in which we can balance appropriately the need for worker safety, food safety, and farmer profits. We don't think the Department of Agriculture, or for that matter, this committee, wants to necessarily have to choose between those three priorities. We need to establish all of them. I believe we can get that done. I believe that there is a willingness on the part of those who represent workers and on the part of the industry to find creative ways to allow adequate processing, but to do so without sacrificing worker safety or health. And that's what we're focused on, and that's what we intend to pursue.
We'll have more later in the show. Our news brief is up next. We will be right back.
Agromiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Root Pack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Root Pack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today. Does your crop have iron chlorosis? AgroPlante has a solution for you. Traditionally, chelated iron has limitations that AgroPlante's Iron Force does not. Iron Force, with its EDDHA chelation technology, can turn your plant's iron chlorosis from yellow to green in as little as 15 days, despite unbalanced soil pH and calcareous soils. From organic certified to conventional micronutrients, AgroPlante has the product for you. Call 559-498-0388 or visit us at www.agroplante.com. The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
Here's your news for today. Global food prices are 32.8% higher compared to September of last year, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations reports. The monthly food price index averaged 130 points in September of 2021. That's up 1.2% from the previous month, also reaching a 10-year high. The increase was largely driven by higher prices of most cereals and vegetable oils. Dairy and sugar prices were also firmer, while the meat price sub-index remained stable. U.S. beef exports soared to another new record value in August, topping the $1 billion mark for the first time. The U.S. Meat Export Federation reports pork exports posted another strong month in August as well, remaining ahead of the record pace established in 2020. Led by record shipments to China and the largest exports of the year to Japan, August beef exports totaled 132,500 metric tons. U.S. Rural Development offers a suite of grants and loans that can be applied to expanding services in rural healthcare facilities. Rod Bain reports.
What are some examples of the Agriculture Department's Rural Development Mission Area providing support to rural healthcare facilities so they can offer needed programs and services to their communities and regions? Family Healthcare of Northwestern Ohio began in 2004 as a federally qualified health center lookalike.
When it was identified that there was a need for low-income people on Medicaid, people that didn't have insurance, there really wasn't anywhere for them to get primary health care.
Executive Director Jennifer Smith says at the time, Family Health Care was only able to provide medical services. However, with dental service identified as a need for their rural facility and clients from the beginning,
we knew if there was ever an opportunity to apply to be a fully funded health center, that would be our first priority.
Once full FQHC status was achieved in 2015, Family Health Care applied for and received a USDA Rural Development Community Facilities loan.
We were able to purchase the building, renovate the building with the expansion that allowed us in that same year to not only now start offering dental services, we started providing behavioral health services as well.
An RD Community Facilities loan, meanwhile, played a part in expansion of services for a one-of-a-kind specialty children's hospital located in rural southeastern New York State.
The center is the largest pediatric program of its kind in New York to deal with children with complex conditions, medical conditions, autism, and other disabilities.
Center of Discovery CEO Patrick Dollard explains this regional facility through the loan will soon offer services on a statewide level.
The overall loan assisted. We were fortunate to be able to pick up a very large building that was unoccupied, which on one level is just going to bring back almost 200,000 square feet of building space to develop the specialty hospital. There'll also be a research institute. There'll be an education school program involved in it, and a number of other possibilities.
Creating a short-term assessment opportunity for children with complex issues, providing education and care during their stay.
It'll be one of the few in the country that's attempting to do that.
While creating economic opportunity by way of construction and jobs for the community and region, according to Dollard. Among Rural Development's grant and loan programs in its portfolio is the newly announced Emergency Rural Health Care Grants. RD is accepting funding applications for that program through October 12th. More information is available through state rural development offices or online at www.rd.usda.gov. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The Environmental Protection Agency announced Thursday the appointment of Rod Snyder to become EPA's agriculture advisor. Snyder will lead the outreach and engagement efforts with the agricultural community for EPA, working to advance the Biden-Harris environmental agenda for farmers and rural communities. Snyder is nationally recognized for his leadership at the intersection of agriculture and environmental policy and joins the agency after serving as president of Field to Market, the Alliance for Sustainable Agriculture. Well, the organization Rural Investment to Protect Our Environment, or known as RIPE, seeks to reward farmers for voluntary stewardship through the RIPE 100 plan. The farmer-led nonprofit seeks to pay farmers $100 per acre, rewarding farmers for the total public value of their conservation practices. In addition to carbon sequestration, the voluntary federal program would pay for improved soil health, cleaner water, biodiversity, and other environmental services. Investors in cooperative businesses like those in agriculture may find various ways to create both equity and returns in their investments. Rod Bain joins us once again.
Member investment is an important pillar of the cooperative business model, as seen in many parts of America, especially rural areas. Yet, as Phil Kinkle of Oklahoma State University Extension points out, there are many examples of what equity and its returns might look like.
In most cooperatives, there is some membership equity. So from in order to me become a member, I make some investment and buy a share of stock, and then that gives me both voting rights and the right to get profits. And then there is structures of revolving equity or proportional equity or equity with associated usage rights. So there's really three different categories there.
Kenkel explains revolving equity and, in turn, how a member may profit from this arrangement.
Most cooperatives you're familiar with use the revolving equity. And so at the end of the year, they pay back their profits, and they pay back that in a combination of cash, which is, of course, your immediate benefit, and then equity. So you build your equity. You build your equity by owning the co-op.
Proportional equity is best exemplified by agricultural cooperatives, such as those in the dairy and cotton sectors.
Those co-ops, they would, it's called a base capital system, and you would have a equity requirement based on the amount of business you're doing. Until you get to that, you get less cash patronage, and then once you build up that you've got the required amount, then now you're fully invested and you would get a higher amount of cash.
The model used by many value-added cooperatives, one example is within the ethanol industry, is what Kenkel calls proportionate share.
So for every bushel of corn I bring to an ethanol co-op, I have to own one own of stock, one share of stock, and that stock has a usage right. I still get the profits off of that one bushel of corn, but my equity was linked to it. And under that model, that's the only co-op model where the equity does actually buy and trade. And so I can sell my shares and usage right to another farmer if they want to buy that to be able to deliver their corn and get the ethanol profits or also done in other value-added businesses.
And some cooperatives issue preferred stocks to both members and non-members.
Preferred stock usually pays a stated dividend. And then in co-ops by federal and a lot of times by state laws, we have a limit on dividends of 8%. Some co-ops actually, when we talk about revolving the equity, they actually revolve it into preferred stocks. We're supposed to be giving most of our returns in proportion to use. And so that's why we put that limit on dividends on the equity. On the preferred stock.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's your news for today. We'll be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
We return now to the House Ag Committee hearing to review the state of the livestock industry and testimony from Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
But I'm concerned that the department has had to revisit the packers and steered rules from the last time when you were secretary. Generally speaking, the rules that are being contemplated will invite litigation. That doesn't help anybody except for the trial lawyers themselves. Is going to reduce contract opportunity. Before any new proposed rules are released, will you commit to having the Office of the Chief Economist conduct a full economic analysis of the cost and benefit of the rules and release that report at the same time of the proposed rules?
Congressman, we will follow the requirements under the administrative law laws and rules that we are governed by in terms of the development of rules and regulations. To the extent that it requires an analysis, we'll obviously do that. To the extent that it requires disclosure, we will do that. We will make sure that the rules that we have are based on an aggressive and thoughtful effort. I can commit to that.
But you can't commit to releasing a report at the same time?
Well, we'll release the information that is required under the administrative rules that provides background and information on why we think this is necessary This is not, we're not playing the ball here. We obviously want folks to understand and appreciate what the issue is and why we're in the process of establishing rules and regulations. You know, Congress passed the Packers and Stockyards Act quite some time ago, understanding and appreciating that there's always a need for oversight, and we expect to do this in a way that's fair and reasonable and equitable.
Well, I think it's important that a full economic analysis of the cost and benefit of the rules is proposed at the same time the proposed rule is put forward. So that point covered. Number two, USDA announced a program to give $700 million to farm and foreign workers impacted by COVID. I'm just curious, will this money be distributed to non-union plants?
The resources, I'm sorry, Representative, I didn't quite hear all of your question. I think you're asking about the resources that are available to for inspections and for modernization. Is that what you're asking about? Whether it's available to plants regardless of unionized status?
Well, you announced $700 million to farm and food workers impacted by COVID.
Those resources are being provided. Those resources are being provided to organizations that have the ability and capacity to distribute those resources to folks who worked in plants and in grocery stores. I would imagine that some of those plants are unionized and perhaps some are not. We will be working through organizations that represent and are in a position to distribute. That's one of the qualifications for participation in that resource.
Okay, so how is it going to be determined that a worker would be eligible for that money?
Well, these are people that worked in farm workers. These are folks who worked in grocery stores. These are folks who worked in meatpacking processing facilities. I think it's fairly relatively simple to explain and to identify folks who worked in those three areas. And it's designed primarily to offset any costs or any expense that they incurred during the initial stages of COVID.
Will there be an audit for any potential fraud and abuse?
Well, I think there's always the possibility of oversight. I don't know if there's going to be a specific audit per se, but there wouldn't be anything preventing that from happening.
Will there be a limit on the amount that goes towards administrative fees for various organizations?
I think there is a limitation on the amount of money that can go for administrative fees. I think the primary goal here is to get the vast amount of these resources in the hands of folks who incurred expense because they had to buy masks or they had to take time off to get vaccinated, whatever it might be.
Time of the gentleman has expired. The gentlewoman from Virginia, Ms. Spanberger, who is also chair of the Subcommittee on Conservation, Forestry, and you're recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Secretary, I want to thank you so much for being here today. And I really thank you for your leadership on promoting competition and supply chain security in the livestock and meatpacking industry. As you mentioned in your testimony, between cyber attacks and pandemic disruptions and other stresses on the U.S. food supply chains, we have seen the issue of consolidation in our meatpacking industry as not just an economic threat to producers, but it's also a national security threat to the United States. As a former CIA officer, I am deeply concerned about the ability of foreign actors to disrupt our agricultural sector, particularly as we see this type of consolidation. That's why I was really proud to co-lead the Butcher Block Act alongside my colleague and fellow committee member, Dusty Johnson. The Butcher Block Act would establish a loan program at USDA for new and expanding meat processors. And I was very excited that just this week, USDA announced a similar loan guarantee initiative that will help expand meat and poultry processing capacity using funds from the American Rescue Plan. So I thank you for that initiative. But for my question today, Mr. Secretary, I want to talk about the climate change. And I want to thank you for your work in bringing growers and producers to the table to combat the climate crisis. And certainly, I once had a farmer say, you know, we're the original conservationists. And certainly, as the original conservationists, farmers in rural communities really have to be an integral part of any solution to the climate crisis. And it was in that vein and with that thought that I was proud to introduce the Growing Climate Solutions Act, H.R. 2820, alongside Representative Don Bacon of Nebraska, also committee member. And ultimately, we were pleased to see that legislation pass the Senate with a vote of 92-8. So the legislation, as I know you're aware, would empower USDA to give farmers or to help farmers navigate voluntary private carbon markets with confidence. With USDA's help, farmers who choose to participate would be able to collect a new stream of revenue for their work. They'd be sequestering carbon and reducing emissions. And the bill is almost universally endorsed by national farm groups while gaining support from prominent environmental groups and private sector companies as well. So I was curious, Secretary Vilsack, from your view of this legislation, do you believe that this legislation would be helpful to growers and producers as you, in your role as secretary, are working on the climate crisis? And would you care to comment on it?
Well, I think it would be incredibly helpful because it's clear that we need to provide more information and more technical assistance in terms of what climate smart practices consist of and how to measure and quantify and verify those results. So the act that you are encouraging your members and your colleagues to vote on, and the one that passed the Senate overwhelmingly, would provide that kind of help and assistance. And I think it would complement nicely the Climate Smart Partnership Initiative we announced last week in Colorado, where we're essentially looking at large-scale demonstration and pilot projects to be able to aggregate information about what works and what doesn't, so that we can, over time, create the standard for climate smart commodities. As was the case with your act, significant support from the agricultural community, a lot of farm groups supporting the Climate Solutions Act. Likewise, both the food and ag and environmental industries very supportive of our efforts to try to focus on these pilots and demonstration projects. So I think it's a nice combination of providing the technical assistance and the resources to minimize risk to farmers and to empower them with information and knowledge about how best to incorporate climate smart practices in their farming operations.
And certainly the trusted voice that is USDA is a valuable resource there. Well, thank you for those comments, music to my ears, and certainly we do hope to be able to move forward and ensure that our farmers and producers can sequester carbon while also ensuring an additional revenue stream, particularly during, particularly given the challenges that so many producers are facing across the country. In the time that I have left, Secretary Vilsack, could you speak a little bit about the loan guarantee program that I mentioned in my comments before I ask the first question? I'm curious how you see this loan guarantee program specifically helping new entrants to the meat packing and processing industry.
Well, we have two basic opportunities for folks who are getting into the business: the $500 million program that was announced several months ago, and the loan guarantee program is really looking at ways in which we can help folks in the middle of the supply chain. There may be a need for cold storage. There may be a need for mobile processing. There may be a need for farmers to work together cooperatively to brand and market a particular product. These resources would basically make it easier for banks, CDFIs, to lend the money to have an entity either get started or to expand or to improve their operation. Right now, many bankers, many CDFIs are not really fully comfortable knowing this area of the middle, and so the loan guarantee makes it a little bit easier for them to make the loans available across the board. But it's primarily designed at the middle of the supply chain. The $500 million is based on creating capital for new processing facilities.
Fantastic. Well, thank you.
The gentlewoman's time has expired. The gentleman from Georgia, Mr. Austin Scott, is recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Secretary Vilsack, thank you for joining us today. My pork producers are telling me that the pork producers still have not been paid the CFAP payments. Is that correct?
I think we've announced those payments, Representative, but I'm more than happy to double check and get back to you with exactly how many dollars have actually been paid out to those producers.
Okay. I would be interested in knowing that on the pork as well as any of the other CFAP payments.
Well, I can tell you that over $4 billion have been distributed to producers, commodity producers, livestock producers. But we can get you very specific information and dollar amounts.
Okay. I would very much appreciate that. Thank you. And I know that, you know, gyps has been brought up a lot. I would just like to point out that Chairman David Scott and I both co-authored a letter to Secretary Perdue outlining our concerns with what had been done in the past. There's historically been pretty broad bipartisan concerns there. And again, would ask that you stay in close contact with the committee on any of the rules and regulations with regard to GPSA. There again has typically been broad bipartisan concern with that particular area of USDA and the rules and regulations. One question I have, and it deals with the Food Safety Inspection Services and the masks. How many businesses have not been allowed to have inspections or have had inspections withheld as a result of noncompliance of that notice?
I understand, Congressman, it is characterized as a handful, somewhere in the neighborhood of less than 10.
Okay. I'll yield the remainder of my time, Mr. Chairman, and certainly by the next panel expect to be in my office and have further questions. But Secretary Vilsack, before I go, certainly would very much appreciate an update in specifics on the CFAP payments. My pork producers are telling me that they have not been paid. And as you know, all of our livestock producers have had a very difficult year.
We're listening to a House Ag Committee hearing. We will have more in just a moment.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you. Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Welcome back. We return now to the House Ag Committee hearing to review the state of the livestock industry and testimony from Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
A woman from Maine. Ms. Pingree, you're recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Secretary, for being with us today. Really appreciate your attention to all this. And I'm glad the chair has decided to have this hearing. I'm going to try to get in 2 questions, so I'll see if I can be quick. I know organic agriculture isn't the primary focus of today's hearing, but it's just so important to my district. During your previous time as the secretary, you finalized the organic livestock and poultry practices rule, and I was disappointed to see that the Trump administration withdrew that. In June, you announced the USDA plans to begin rulemaking on these standards again. I just want to reiterate how essential it is to have meaningful, well-defined standards for organic livestock and poultry. Could you give us a little update on the progress? And I know that there is a legal challenge going on, but I'm wondering if you could start the rulemaking even with the litigation ongoing.
We've actually started that process, Congresswoman. We anticipate and expect an opportunity to get what we are working on to our general counsel for review in the very near future, into OMB, hopefully by the end of this year, and hopefully seeing some progress in terms of publication in 2022. We understand and appreciate the need to get this done, and we that and the origin of livestock rule are two things that we are prioritizing.
Great. Well, again, I don't have to remind you that having standards that really recognize the inputs that people have who are doing the, doing what they need to do as organic producers is just so critical and really is a challenge to those, to the marketplace right now. We're certainly talking a lot about meat processing today, and I just want to focus a little bit on the small scale meat processors. I appreciate the attention to increasing resilience and diversity in meat and poultry processing, and I know that you've given that renewed interest, including the $500 million investment that's been announced and to support new competitive entrants into the sector, and certainly you've talked a little bit about that today. But I just want to focus more on the smaller scale producers, including help for existing small scale producers to expand and upgrade their infrastructure. What are the USDA's plans for supporting small processors within the $500 million investment will support for the existing federal inspected small processors to upgrade their facilities be included in the program? That seems like somewhat of an oversight to me.
Well, I think the reason why we are focused on new processing capacity with the $500 million is because you all have identified additional resources available to small and very small processing facilities that wish to modernize. That's the grant program that I alluded to earlier, roughly $55 million. We received 240-some applications for those resources. These are $200,000 grants that will enable those small producers, if they wish to, upgrade their system so that they can qualify for interstate transactions, which would expand their market. And so we want to see where that goes, and we want to see what the demand is. In addition, we obviously as well have the $100 million that's been provided to reduce overtime costs to help small and very small producers, processing facilities pay for federal inspection and for their inspectors. That has been a very popular effort. Almost 1,900 operations are taking advantage of that. So those two areas are areas that we are providing help and assistance. The $500 million, we'll see essentially how the $55 million operates and see if there's additional demand. If there is, we can make some adjustments, or we can take a look at additional resources in that processing grant program.
Great. And I really appreciate how important that is and how big of a roadblock this is for so many producers who are finding, you know, increased interest in the market. A lot of people want to buy locally raised meat, and they want to buy it from, you know, farms that are using sustainable methods, but there is such a backlog in the processing. I know I don't have to tell you that, but it's just a huge issue in our region. I'm just going to clarify, because I think I heard you right, and I know one grant can't do everything, but under the meat and poultry inspection readiness grants, if you're already a federally inspected processor, but you want to expand your capacity, you currently aren't eligible. Is that correct?
I think that is correct, but I could be corrected on that, but I believe that's correct. The goal of this was to try to give people the ability to expand their capacity and expand their market opportunities.
Right. Okay. I'll clarify that with you, and I appreciate your answers, and I'm out of time, but thank you for being with us here today.
The general lady from Missouri, Ms. Hutzler, you are now recognized for 5 minutes.
Great. Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Secretary Vilsack. I wanted to actually build on the question that we just heard from my colleague, Representative Pilgrey, about the $500 million grants that are being under review right now. I want to encourage you to include the smaller plants that stood up after COVID began. I would hope that you will consider the definition of new plant as including new as in from the start of the pandemic, because I'm aware of some facilities that, with the problem that was we were seeing, stood up during that time frame, and they went in debt to build these facilities, and I'm concerned that they won't be able to qualify for some of these funds that are very, very important. So I sure hope that you will consider that in the process.
Well, as I indicated, we received over 500 comments. I suspect those comments will be incorporated. It will obviously take your concerns into consideration. Yeah, I expect and anticipate that the demand is going to be in excess of what we have resources for the very reason that you've just alluded to. There are facilities that were in the planning stage. There were facilities that are about ready to operate, and they may need operating resources as opposed to capital to get to build. So I think we're going to find a lot from this particular program, and the goal here is to learn so that in turn, as you all look at farm bill programs and things of that nature, there may be lessons that could be applied to additional programs that could be established on a more permanent basis in this space.
Well, thank you. And another area of concern that I'm hearing from several of our USDA offices is this concern with the vaccine mandate that has been put down by the administration. There's the thinking that many USDA offices will have to close because individuals just do not feel comfortable for whatever reason in taking the vaccine. And I was hoping that you would be open to allowing for some exemptions of these mandates if the individuals already had antibodies in their system or if they did other precautions, rather than having these offices close and our farmers not have access to the services. Are you open to setting up some sort of an exemption service to keep them open and allow the workers to continue to come if the offices are going to close or if it's going to significantly hamper the operations?
Well, there are provisions in the proposal for religious exemptions and for health exemptions, and so we'll certainly respect those. And I would anticipate and expect that we will do what we need to do to keep offices open. At the end of the day, we don't want to necessarily reduce the service to people that need the service. So I don't anticipate that we're actually going to see a significant number of closed offices that would significantly reduce our capacity to serve farmers and ranchers in your state and other states.
Great. That's great news. I appreciate that. In the outdated Packers and Stockyard Act, there is a prohibition that individuals who own sale barns cannot also have a packing facility. And this is, I think, detrimental to our goal to be able to increase the packing capacity. And so are you open to looking at removing this barrier to entry to allow people active in the livestock sector already to invest in local and regional processing?
Congressman, this is the first time that question's been asked of me, and I'm probably not in a position to say yes or no. I'm more than happy to go back to the office and talk to our folks as they're putting this rule together. I want to make sure that I'm not interfering with the capacity of the rulemaking process, but certainly will be glad to ask the team that question.
Wonderful. And I appreciate the chairman started off asking a question about the vaccine for the African swine fever, and that's certainly very, very encouraging. You probably are aware, though, of some other wonderful technology that at the University of Missouri, they have developed a pig that is immune to or resistant to PRRS. And of course, that's also one of the world's very costly animal diseases. But because of the jurisdictional mayhem between the USDA and the FDA, this technology is not yet available to producers. It hasn't been approved. So can you please share your goals for ensuring that there's an appropriate regulatory structure for agriculture to use the tools that we have in addressing these environmental disease and food safety issues?
Well, that's a great question, and it's one that I would sort of align myself with you on. I think there are ways in which we have to work collaboratively with our friends at FDA to make sure that our regulatory system is able to respond quickly enough and be able to keep aligned or keep pace with the pace of change. And I could give you several examples where I think we have work to do in that space. And I've expressed that to our friends at FDA.
That entire hearing was several hours long. You can find the entire hearing on the House Ag Committee's website. That's our show for today. If there's a topic you'd like to know more about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.